You see, I'm running a little short this week, and I'm wondering if you can loan me $50. And Jim says, I don't know, Bob, $50 is a lot of money. Why should I loan it to you? And Bob says to Jim, well, do you remember years ago when we were in the service and we were in combat together and you were injured? And I crawled on my hands and my knees to get to you and pull you to safety and get you to healing. Do you remember that I did that for you, Jim? And Jim says, yeah, I remember that. And Bob says, do you remember when your house burned down and I let you stay with me for months on end until we could rebuild your house? And Jim said, yeah, I remember that too. And Bob says, do you remember when you got sick and you needed a kidney? And I was there for you and I gave you one of my kidneys. Doesn't any of this mean anything to you, Bob? Doesn't it count for something? And Jim says, well, yeah, Bob, but you know, that was years ago. What have you done for me lately? Now, you could also add an addendum on that today. You could have Bob say, Jim, what about that ride I gave you to work this week? And Jim could say, yeah, but an Uber only costs $15. Why would I give you $50? So this is kind of an old joke, and you've probably heard it in some former fashion before, but it kind of reflects the attitude we sometimes have when it comes to being grateful for the blessings that we have. The attitude is, your good deed, your favor was so long ago, I barely remember it. What have you done for me lately? A business leader by the name of Harvey McKay once said, when you do someone a favor, their gratitude typically lasts as long as it takes them to say they will be eternally grateful. That's kind of a cynical attitude, but I suspect he probably spoke from personal experience in regards to that. Now, none of us really want to be that person that's that ungrateful, that's that short-sighted. But unless we're careful, we can kind of slip into that mode without ever realizing it. Unless we make an intentional effort to eliminate the enemies of gratitude, we'll wind up being that person at some point or another. It's all too easy to overlook the blessings that come our way, especially when we're facing the struggles that we have. We do this sometimes. We overlook the blessings we have sometimes, particularly when it comes to our relationship with God. So, if anyone ever wanted to see what a "what have you done for me lately" attitude in Scripture looked like, all they would have to do is look to the children of Israel and the story of Moses. Now, you remember the story, right? The Hebrews were enslaved in Egypt under a very powerful Pharaoh. 400 years they were enslaved. And at some point, God spoke to Moses. Now, whenever you say Moses, I automatically picture Charlton Heston. They spoke to Moses. And wasn't that a great movie? How great a movie is that? Is whenever somebody says Moses, you think of Charlton Heston. So anyway, God spoke to Moses and he said, go to the Pharaoh, the most powerful man in our world, and tell him you must let our people go. And he did that. And he came back with his skin. Not only did he come back with his skin and alive, he came back with all the Israelites in tow. He left the kingdom and led them to freedom into the desert, towards the land of milk and honey. But they weren't safe yet because Pharaoh wasn't done with them. He sent his armies after them. Okay? And they came to the Red Sea. And they were felt trapped against the Red Sea. But God told Moses to tell the Israelites to stand firm and they would see the mighty hand of God at work. Then he stood at the banks, and I'm going to do my best Moses now, and he spread his hands, and the Red Sea miraculously parted. And the Israelites crossed across to the other side. And when the Egyptian army approached, he closed the sea again, and the Israelites were safe. And now he didn't only just do that. He preserved them from the Egyptian army, but he provided for them as they wandered the desert for the coming years. God watched over them. He provided clouds by day to shield them from the sun, and he provided them a fire by night to keep them warm. And he also provided them with food in the form of manna from heaven throughout their journey. Now, if you don't know manna is a seed-like substance that can be crushed, and it can be ground into, like, I assume, a porridge type of thing, or it can be made into cakes, things like that. Not very exciting food, but you had plenty of it, and you didn't go hungry, despite that you were in a land that was lacking water and food. Now, you might be thinking the people of Israel must be falling to their knees every day as they're in the desert and praising God, thank you for all the many blessings. You might think that this is just a miracle that happens to us every day, and yet that's not what they said at all. If we go to the book of Numbers, chapter 11, verses 4 through 6, we can read what the Israelites said. The rabble with them began to crave other food, and again the Israelites started wailing and said, if only we had meat to eat. Now that's not really a good wail, is it? We all know what a good wail is. If only we had meat to eat. We remember the fish we ate in Egypt at no cost. Also the cucumbers, melons, leeks, onions, and garlic. But now we have lost our appetite. We never see anything but this manna. There are three words that stand out in verse 4 that I think we ought to focus on today. The first one is the word rabble. Now, what do you think of when I say the word rabble? I remember I had an aunt when I was a kid. I was playing with my two older brothers and my cousins, and we were upstairs in a room, probably, I'm sure we were quiet as church mice. But she opened the door and stuck her head in and said something to the effect of, what are you rabble doing up here? So you can imagine what rabble really stands for. What kind of people are these? Troublemakers. They're getting into trouble. They're noisy. They're complainers, whiners, moaners. These are all the people. Well, let me ask you, do we have rabble in our world today? Yeah, we have a lot of rabble in our world. They're up to no good. They grouse and they grumble and they complain that nearly everything they do is wrong. We're surrounded by rabble of all sorts. All you have to do is turn on the television and you will find rabble. But you won't just find them on TV. You'll find them in church, too. You'll find them at work, definitely at work. You'll find them everywhere you go. They love to moan and groan and find fault in everything and everybody. And now part of you can say, how do I deal with these folks? And you can say, I can try and convert them and point out the error of their ways. But how often does that really work? You know, how often does that really affect a change in that person? So sometimes the best thing you can do with those people is to get a little distance, because you know what? If you hang around with people like that, pretty soon you're going to fall into it yourself. You know, you're right. That so-and-so over there makes fried bacon in the microwave every morning, and it just stinks. True story from work. King David talked about this first Psalm. Yes, a guy made bacon in the microwave every morning, and yes, it didn't smell very good. King David talked about this in the first Psalm. Blessed is the one who does not walk in step with the wicked, or stand in the way of sinners, or sit in the company of mockers. Ooh, that's kind of strong, isn't it? So he's associating the wicked and sinners in the company of people who mock. That's a name you could call somebody. You're a mocker. You don't hear that too often. But that's a pretty strong statement, isn't it? I like it. So when you find yourself in the presence of someone who is that disgruntled, find yourself in the presence of someone who's a rabble, or you turn on a television show, particularly, I don't know, political commentary, sports analyst, movie critics, if you can't convert them, maybe the best thing you can do is separate yourself from them, because being that person, being that rabble, separates you from a life of gratitude. It separates you from God and really appreciating all that God has given to you. The second word I want to talk to you about is the word crave. The rabble with them began to crave. They had plenty to eat, but it just wasn't good enough. Now, I don't know how you feel, but if I had to eat manna every day for 40 years, yeah, I might want something a little different. But the difference between wanting something a little different, a little variety, and craving is they didn't just want it, they needed it. They demanded it. They felt they deserved it. So craving isn't just a matter of wanting a little variety in your diet. It was an entitlement. They wanted it, and they thought that God owed it to them. And that was part of the problem. They felt entitled to it. So what did they do that really allowed them to be entitled? What did they really do? Well, they were slaves and they were freed, and they were set in the desert and provided food and promised the land of milk and honey. What did they really do to deserve this blessing and to be ungrateful towards God? They really didn't do anything. And the problem with craving is that it's so much a part of our world these days and that we're encouraged to crave things. How many times do you see a commercial where somebody says, you need to take this vitamin so you can be young and virile again? Because that's something you need to be. Forget the fact that aging is normal. You know, and we don't get a chance to be young more than once. You know, you need to have this car because when you have this car, you'll be super cool and people will just love you. And it doesn't matter how much the car costs, you need to crave this. We are taught to crave. But craving gives us a false sense of entitlement and it gets in our way of really appreciating the many blessings that we have. Now, maybe you've recognized this tendency in people in the past. It's easy to see it in others. But have you recognized it in yourself? It's always the desire that what I have isn't enough. I want more. Now, there's another story about a grandmother that was watching her grandchild play on the beach one afternoon when a huge wave came in and washed the child off ashore, pulled him far out into the sea. And when she noticed this, she fell to her knees and she cried out to God, God, please bring him back. I can't swim. I can't go get him. Please bring him back. And as soon as she said that, another wave came and washed the child back to the shore. And she grabbed him and she held him and she wept. And then she looked around a little bit and she looked up towards God and said, he had a hat. This is craving. This is an example of what you give me is great, but it's not good enough. I want more. What entitled her to this? Okay, it's not good enough. Craving is also the child of perfectionism, and perfectionism is the mortal enemy of appreciation. The perfect sandwich, the perfect dining experience don't exist, and yet we expect that every time we go to a restaurant. How many times have you seen somebody just absolutely berate a waiter or a waitress because the rolls aren't just quite perfect, or the dinner's too salty, or it's something that's really out of the control of that person, but yet they feel it should be, no matter what. They don't appreciate everything that that person has done for them. What do you crave? What do you feel entitled to? What do you find yourself demanding? These are obstacles to a life of gratitude. The first word was rabble. The second word is crave. And the third word is wail. Now, this is a pretty descriptive word, isn't it? We all know what wailing is, especially if you've ever had children or ever been around children or ever been in a restaurant with children. Children wail all the time. The verse that we read says, the rabble with them began to crave other food, and again the Israelites started wailing. Now, wailing isn't just crying out for something. It's red-faced, and it's stomping, and it's shouting at the sky, or shouting at, you know, if you're in case of a parent, it's shouting at you. I really want that truck, if you're at the store or whatever it is. You know, wailing is not just complaining. It's shouting out. It's dramatic. Now, what did the Israelites really say? Well, they said what all wailers say. They always say, if only. From the book of Numbers, they said, the Israelites started wailing and said, if only we had meat to eat. If only we had some meat, then everything would be perfect. What do you do in your life? If only I had a better job, my life would be so much better. If only I had more pay, my life would be so much better. If only if I were married, my life would be better. If only I were single. We're always in a constant state of if only. And we live in a society that prizes that too. If only I had that car, that vitamin or that physique or whatever, our life would be much more complete. I could go on and on. We all know examples of it, and I'm sure many of you are thinking back there going, yeah, I've done that, yeah, and I'm guilty of it too as well. But recognize that this wailing is part of what separates you from God, part of what separates you from living a life of appreciation, and part of what separates you from truly appreciating all that God has given to you. Now, I've mentioned three words to you today, rabble, crave, and wail, and together they define a word that is the heart of an ungrateful attitude, and that's called perfectionism. Now, when I talk about perfectionism, I'm not talking about pursuing excellence, because when you try to be the best you can be, when you try to pursue excellence, you're not so concerned about mistakes. You're concerned about not learning from your mistakes. You know, you don't get hung up when somebody doesn't do something perfectly because you understand that there is a whole highway wide of right answers to most problems. You just need to find one, and there's more than one way to get there. But if you're a perfectionist, there is only one right answer, and it is my answer. The problem is my version of perfect and your version of perfect are probably not the same. So that leads to conflict. Okay? So how do we go from wailing about our cravings with the rest of the rabble to being proactively appreciative of all the blessings that have come our way? Well, we can start by looking at the word of Paul in the book of Thessalonians, chapter 3, verses 9 through 10. Now, these words were written by Paul to the church in Thessalonica, a church that held a special place in his heart. It was one of the first churches he planted and one of the first letters he wrote, and this was a church that he was particularly proud of. It was a thriving congregation, and they had become an example of all other churches should follow. And the verse reads like this: "How can we thank God enough for you in return for all the joy we have in the presence of our God because of you? Night and day we pray most earnestly that we may see you again and supply what is lacking in your faith." So let's break this down a little bit. Paul comes right out and says, thank you. Thank you for who you are. Two words in the English language, or two phrases in the English language, that I think are never used enough is thank you and I'm sorry. Thank you for whatever you do, even if it's just handing me a pen. Thank you. Even if it's just holding the door. Thank you. It's an easy phrase, and it makes people feel so good about themselves, and it shows your appreciation. The other one, I think, is I'm sorry. When you don't know what to say, when someone is going through a difficult time, the word is I'm sorry. I wish I could change it. But always start with I'm sorry. Two words we frequently forget, two phrases we frequently forget. But Paul starts out by saying thank you. He mentions here and elsewhere he's praying for them. Another good thing to say. I am praying for you in your situation, in your circumstance. That means I'm with you. I'm sharing your struggles with you. He expresses his appreciation in the most practical terms. He says, we want to visit you again and supply what is lacking in your faith. Now, this means a lot of different things at that time. It might mean money to help them with their church. It might mean praying with them. It might mean preaching to them, or explaining what's going on in other churches. All these things, he's saying, I am here to support you and to help you to grow. I am with you in your life struggles. Paul is saying, in effect, we thank you for all you have done for us, and now we're mapping out all we can do for you in return. Jesus taught that when you do something for someone else, you should do it without expecting anything in return. In the book of Luke, chapter 6, verse 35, love your enemies and do good to them, and lend to them without expecting to get anything back. In Luke 14, he said, when you hold a banquet, don't just invite friends and relatives who can return the favor. Invite the poor and the outcast, who may never be able to return your favor. This attitude fuels our giving. We give without expectation of anything in return. This is how we give, but not how we receive. We are to receive with a determination to return that blessing. Paul says to the Thessalonians, look at how you've blessed us. We want to bless you even more. That's what we mean by proactive appreciation. It says, I recognize the value of what you have done, and I will not rest until I do something in return, either for you, doing something directly for you, or doing something for someone else in your name. Okay? So it's not necessarily a question of repaying that individual, although that's certainly a good way. It can be, you have helped me to allow me to help others, and I will do that because you have helped me. I will demonstrate my gratitude with my words and my actions. I will serve you in the same way you have blessed me. Now, we all know who the actor Tom Hanks is. Does anybody know that he had a TV show in the 1980s called Bosom Buddies? Anybody remember that? Yeah, I thought that was a good show. I was like, 14 at the time. It was kind of a goofy comedy. It was a show where there was two guys. I think his other partner on the show was a guy by the name of Rick Moranis, who's also a star, too. It wasn't? Who was it? Peter Scolari. Thank you. So the subject, there's a Bosom Buddies expert here. Good to know. But the whole premise of the thing is they lived in this apartment complex that would only accommodate young single women. So to go home every night, they had to dress as women. And it was a goofy comedy, and it was kind of funny. And, you look back at Tom Hanks' career, and you think, well, he might be a little embarrassed by this. But a guy by the name of Tom Miller, who was a producer on that show, tells a story about Tom Hanks. You see, he was a new aspiring actor at that time, and he didn't have much money. So early on, he went to Tom Miller, and he said, "Tom, I'm having trouble paying my bills. I'm having trouble keeping my rent up. Can you loan me $5,000 just till the salary starts coming in?" And Tom thought about that request, and he went a step further, and he thought, "Well, I'm going to help you out. I think you've got a lot of talent." So he loaned him $10,000. And Tom Hanks, to his credit, put off, when the paycheck started coming in from the series, he put off buying those expensive things that, you know, celebrities like, the fancy cars, the fancy clothes. He put that off until he could pay Tom Miller off in full. Now, you might think that now when he sees Tom Miller, he might be saying, "Oh, that show, the embarrassment of my career. You know, I kind of wish people didn't watch that anymore. You know, I've done far more serious work. That's the most embarrassing credit on my resume. I really, really, really don't want people to notice that." But that's not what he says. Every time he sees Tom Miller, he thanks him for being so generous to him when he was early on in his career. And he tells everybody that he helped him get started in this business. He's appreciative. He's truly grateful. How would an attitude like this affect you if you were grateful for the things that people did for you always? It'll strip away your sense of entitlement. It'll strip away your tendency to demand perfection from everybody and accept the blessings that you get as they are. It'll take away that tendency to want to be one of the rabble, to want to crave things that may or may not make your life better, and to wail about it when you don't get what you want. Many things we find when we check the score sheet is that we have been on the receiving end of so many blessings from God and from those around us that we will never be able to repay everything that we have been given. But it's certainly worth the effort to try. We become better people when we do. We can reach out to those who have blessed us, offer a word of gratitude. We can serve them or minister to them in some capacity. We can look at the blessings that God has poured out in our lives, and we can respond with a heart fully devoted to Him and a determination to serve Him more every day. We receive with a determination to return that blessing, and in turn are blessed even more richly. And if you're ever tempted to say, "What have you done for me lately, the answer is, "You've already done more than I can ever repay, but I intend to try." Okay, I think now is the time for our offer.